right, so today we're going to talk about inhibitory amino acid receptors. Primarily then that would mean receptors for glycine and for GABA. And specifically, we're going to be talking about inotropic receptors again today. That's the sorts of things we're going to be covering for this next exam, ion channels, and then everything relevant from the first exam that impacts ion channels, of course. Okay. So there are other types of GABA receptors. We're going to be talking about GABA A receptors, and then a little bit about GABA C receptors today. All right, these are pentameric receptors. Have we seen any pentameric receptors previously?
Yes.
Okay. And they're a bit different from receptors that have four subunits. And it might be good, again, we have an event coming up on Tuesday, to keep track of the difference between those that have four subunits and those that have five. Is that a fairly broad hint there? Hopefully so. GABA A's, GABA C's, and glycine receptors all have five subunits. These are all inhibitory receptors. For the GABA A's, they're made up of alpha subunits, beta subunits, and sometimes gamma subunits. Very commonly, though, the alphas and betas predominate. You can have different combinations of those, and we'll look at that in just a little more detail in a moment. GABA C's are completely unique from the others. They're made up of, anybody know what that Greek letter is? Rho subunits. Completely different protein structure, but still forming this five subunit configuration for gamma. And then glycine subunits, again, alphas and betas. Okay. Five total to make up a receptor. Please don't write down all the detail on this slide, but again, these inhibitory receptors share a great deal of common structure. We talk about this as conservation of the protein structure. The alpha subunits, for instance, are very identical to one another. Much of their amino acid sequence is the same. And then the different types of subunits, there's some identity. If you notice, the rho subunits are the most different from all of the other types of subunits. And as we'll see, that gives some special properties to GABA C receptors that other type of GABA receptors don't have. Okay. Now we've talked about synapses for different types of neurotransmitters, and we've talked about general things about synapses. I wanted to give one specific example here of how we put together a glycine receptor complex in the nervous system, how nature puts these together. It utilizes a specific protein called gefferin. Gefferin is a glycine receptor anchoring protein. And what it does is attach two or more glycine receptors together in a cluster that is then anchored to specific cytoskeletal elements, neurofilaments and microtubules. And what happens is then on the surface of a neuron. If we were looking at the neuron from the outside, we would see clusters of receptors for glycine. We might also see a similar sorts of clustering for glutamate receptors. And we looked at, for instance, a complex that tied in NMDA receptors and AMPA receptors and metabotropic glutamate receptors together previously. In the case of glycine receptors, a lot of work has been done. So in the native or wild-type state, receptor complexes might be clustered together into synaptic groups. If you knock out this particular protein, gefferin, so we have a gefferin knockout, then you'll still have expression of glycine receptors, but they won't be clustered together to form a synapse. They'll be fairly uniformly distributed across the cell membrane. Glutamate receptors are unaffected by the loss of this protein. They don't use gefferin for their clustering. They use proteins like PSD95. So as a consequence, in these mutant animals that are lacking gephrin, inhibitory transmission is seriously screwed up. Most of them do not survive to infancy, much less to adulthood. Severe seizure disorders, all sorts of other developmental problems as well. Because on the presynaptic side, the release sites haven't changed. But postsynaptically, the receptors are not tightly clustered together underneath those release sites. And so a neurotransmitter to hit these randomly scattered receptors has to travel a great distance and very often will be taken back up by transporters instead. So not having that clustering, just a single key protein, can greatly change the system. Okay. So if these are inhibitory transmitters, what sort of events would they cause in postsynaptic cells? Inhibitory postsynaptic potentials, IPSPs. And if we're looking at a voltage signal here, you would see it as a hyperpolarization of the membrane. And it should in some way, if you're looking at a graph of that, mention that you're looking at voltage, not looking at current here. Okay. These form chloride channels, so when they're gated by binding of the ligand and activated, chloride ions flow down their concentration gradient. Where is there more chloride ions? Outside or inside the neuron? Outside the neuron. So when they flow down their concentration gradient, they generate an inward current. What kind of ion are these? Are these cations? Anions, negatively charged. So carrying that negative charge inside the membrane hyperpolarizes the cell. If we look at the iPSCs that are caused by activation of glycine receptors, are generating these nice strong inward currents anywhere down close to the resting potential of the cell. I show you this sort of an equation. What would you tell me the Hill coefficient is for glycine receptors? It has a Hill coefficient of 2, so how many molecules of glycine would be required to activate these receptors? 2 molecules. Okay. Again, you should be able to be building on prior knowledge at this point in time. All right. Let's look next at ligands for glycine receptors. Anybody know where glycine receptors are found? Primarily in the spinal cord, but there are some in the brainstem as well, down in the medulla, which very strongly resembles the anatomical structure of the spinal cord. Now we have agonists and antagonists for glycine receptors. Not surprisingly, the predominant agonist is glycine. Glycine is an inhibitory amino acid. Could be abbreviated GLY. But there are some very close relatives to glycine which will also agonize these receptors. Another one is alanine. Very similar structure. Almost looks like someone's dog, and this one has a little better developed head on the dog. Alanine. Or another substance that we looked at before that was a sulfate-containing amino acid. Taurine. Everyone remember taurine? Again, a slightly different structure over here. Where might you encounter taurine? Red Bull, something like that. Okay. Taurine's not very readily transported across the blood-brain barrier. Or else a can of Red Bull might knock you unconscious. There are some partial agonists of glycine receptors. One that you're most likely to see is a compound abbreviated BABA. Sounds like baby talk. BABA. Or maybe Charlie Sheen would use that kind of word these days. BABA. These glycine receptors, and we mentioned this terminology before too, are considered to be strychnine sensitive glycine receptors. Strychnine sensitive glycine receptors. Strychnine is a very potent competitive antagonist for glycine receptors. What does that mean? What does it prevent binding of? It competes for binding with glycine or alanine or taurine or any of the other agonists that bind to the agonist binding site. Okay. What was the strychnine insensitive type of receptor? It also bound glycine, though. We talked last week about a strychnine insensitive receptor found in the central nervous system. Everybody's blank to everything we talked about last week. If it helps, it starts with
NMDA.
NMDA receptors. They also bound glycine, correct? As a coagonist. Or serine. Slightly different list of amino acids. But that site was not strychnine sensitive. Strychnine does nothing to NMDA receptors. So the protein structure on NMDA receptors that binds glycine is different from the protein structure on these glycine receptors that bind glycine. This one also will bind strychnine. What was another difference between an NMDA receptor and a glycine receptor? This one's inhibitory. What's the other one? Excitatory. This one's a chloride channel. What's the other one? Pardon? I hear some mumbling, but I don't hear any distinctive answer. What type of channel is an NMDA receptor? Calcium channel. Okay. There are lots of other antagonists. I think you've got more than enough to learn right now. That's the one that you will most commonly see. Finally, we've also got non-competitive antagonists. Non-competitive, would that compete for binding with glycine? No, these block the ion channel. And the one that you'll probably be able to buy occasionally, and it's been known since antiquity as a poison. It literally means bitter poison or bitter toxin. Picrotoxin. Picrotoxin. Causes massive convulsions. The Romans were particularly fond of it back in Caesar's day. Had to be disguised with honey or something else to cover that bitterness. People got in the habit of having food tasters to see if there was picrotoxin in their food. If the food taster went into convulsions a minute or two later, they knew that probably wasn't the right dessert to eat. Picrotoxin has a unique feature, well, actually not too unique to things we've talked about so far, in that it gets metabolized, if you survive the initial dose, into a compound called picrotoxinin. Picrotoxinin. And that one is also a potent non-competitive antagonist. So you get twice as much value for your poisoning dollar. If the poison itself doesn't kill the victim, the metabolite probably will. Makes it particularly difficult to have someone survive poisoning with a compound like this. So picrotoxin and then its active metabolite, picrotoxinin. Let's talk about transporters for glycine. Don't think you'll ever be expected to draw a molecule like this. If you're interested, it has 12 transmembrane segments. There are multiple different transporters. The first two are called GlyTs. Gly for glycine, T for transporters. Slightly different proteins, but they're called GlyT1 and GlyT2. They're found in both glial cells and in neurons, much more commonly expressed in neurons than in glia. So the majority of the glycine that gets released in the synapse will get recycled back into neurons. A smaller percentage will get drawn up into glial cells and be unavailable. We also have vesicular transporters. We get neurotransmitter in the vesicles. And rather than being called a V-glyte, we use a more generic term, vesicular inhibitory amino acid transporter. Vesicular inhibitory amino acid transporter. Whose iPhone is this? Anybody? Nobody wants to admit it? You missed a call from your dad. Okay. Vesicular inhibitory amino acid transporter. From the name, since it's not called just the glycine, you're in luck. It also transports GABA. But some of the things you'll learn about it here will transfer over when we talk about GABA in just a moment as well. Okay. It's probably useful to learn a blocker for each of these. Sarcosine is the one that's most commonly used to block GlyT1s. Sarcosine. Amoxapine almost sounds like a detergent. It's used experimentally as a convulsant, and it blocks GlyT2s. And this drug we'll talk about multiple times over the next few minutes. Nipocotate. And that's the English version of it. In America, we would probably more commonly call it nipocotic acid. But again, the Brits studied this first, so we typically use the British English form, nipocotate, just like we did for glutamic acid, glutamate, etc. Okay. So if you wanted to block packaging of glycine up into vesicles for release, you would use a drug like nipocotate. Okay, that was it for glycine. Let's kind of flip it around and look at GABA. GABA. Turns out we have three distinctive proteins for GABA transport across cell membranes. They're called GATs. G for GABA, actually GA for GABA, and T for transporter. So GAT1, GAT2, and GAT3. Now it's not like in Chicago when you're talking about a pistol. GATs, 1, 2, and 3. There's another very obscure one I'm not even going to ask you to learn, but you might be interested in the future. That is both a GABA and a betaine transporter. It's found primarily in the kidneys, but it does play its role in the couple very obscure neurological diseases as well. The BGT. And then finally, the vesicular transporter we talked about previously, VIAAT, vesicular inhibitory amino acid transporter. Again, 12 transmembrane segment proteins. GAT1s and GAT3s are found in neurons and glial cells. Again, predominating in neurons, but also in glia. And I've taken some mercy on you. If you remember nipocotate, it blocks those as well as blocking GAT2s, as well as blocking the vesicular inhibitory amino acid transporter. There are lots of other drugs to accomplish that too. But nipocotate is the one that would be most commonly used because it's so nonspecific. It blocks all of these. GEP2s are sort of a special case. They're involved in transport across the blood-brain barrier, both the pia mater and the arachnoid. Remember, we've got the dura and the arachnoid and the pia mater. They're involved in that blood-brain barrier transport. And besides being blocked by nicotate, you could use a drug like guvacine. Guvacine. To block that blood-brain barrier transport. And if you wanted to get a little bit more selective on blocking packaging of inhibitory transmitters, you just wanted to block GABA transport, use a drug like vigabatrin. Vigabatrin. Almost sounds like a diet drug or something. Vigabatrin. To block GABA transport into vesicles. But if you only had to memorize a single drug from this chart, or if you were only willing to, what would be your best chance? Nipocotate. Okay, you'd probably lose fewer points on the exam not remembering the other ones than not remembering nipocotate. If I were you, I'd try to learn them all, though. At least the ones in color. All right, are GABAergic neurons found in synapses? Do we have inhibitory synapses in the nervous system? Okay. Again, a cartoon-looking view is shown down at the bottom right. Can't actually see that very well with lights on in the room. Can't really see it well with this projector, even with the lights off, unfortunately. Looking at an inhibitory neuron there, stained with one of the biosynthetic enzymes. And we'll look at synthesis of GABA again in just a moment. Typically, we'll have a presynaptic cell in these cartoons, a postsynaptic cell, and a glial cell. When we stimulate the presynaptic cell, drop it to fire an action potential, postsynaptically we will see iPSPs generated by activation of these gamma A receptors. Okay. Presynaptically, we have to have the mechanisms for generating GABA. What was the necessary precursor to produce GABA? Does anybody remember? Glycine. To produce GABA, not glycine. Glutamate, the excitatory neurotransmitter, is necessary to produce the major inhibitory transmitter in the central nervous system. So all of the things we talked about biosynthesis of glutamate have to be present in these presynaptic neurons, plus one more enzyme. Everybody remember what that one more enzyme was? So right here, they convert glu into GABA. GAD, glutamic acid decarboxylase, GAD. That was named by Americans, obviously, because it's called glutamic acid decarboxylase, not glutamate decarboxylase. So if a neuron has GAD in its axon terminals, and it probably has it in its cell body as well, so it can ship it down to the terminals, it's an inhibitory neuron. If it doesn't, and it has all the rest of the synthetic machinery, it's an excitatory neuron. It's easy to tell them apart. It has to be packaged up in the vesicles by the vesicular inhibitory amino acid transporter. What's required for release of these transmitters? Calcium, so you have to have the calcium channels and all the snare protein, and all the rest of the stuff we talked about earlier, has its effect on the postsynaptic cells. What kind of ion channel was it? Chloride channel. Okay. Then it can be taken back up into the neurons or into the glial cells by the GATs, GABA transporters. and then it could be packaged back up again. Or it could be broken down. Is everybody clear on these different routes by which it gets cycled around through different pathways? You've got all the bits and pieces in your notes already. Just hang them together conceptually now. We saw real similar diagrams for other types of synapses as well. Okay, again, we've already looked at everything that led up to biosynthesis of glutamate. Things like aspartate, aminotransferase, other enzymes. You convert glutamate into GABA, make this an inhibitory neuron. We have to have this enzyme, GASH. That's the transmitter that gets packaged up and released. When GABA is not protected in a vesicle, be acted upon by other enzyme systems. The first one that will target GABA is one called GABA-T. GABA-T. GABA transaminase. GABA-T is easier to spell. That will convert GABA into a fairly noxious substance, succinate semialdehyde. Succinate semialdehyde. And anytime you see a compound that has aldehyde in its suffix, those are substances that are liable to be associated with specific effects in your head. Anyone here ever had a hangover? Whether from alcohol or various other causes, aldehydes are typically implicated in that. Aldehydes don't just come from degradation of alcohol. They come from degradation of many of our primary neurotransmitters as well. Degradation of GABA generates an aldehyde, succinate semialdehyde. To get rid of that noxious substance, we have another enzyme, succinate semialdehyde dehydrogenase. And again, you probably want to use the abbreviation SSDH. SSDH breaks down that noxious aldehyde into succinate, which can then be used in things like the Krebs cycle. Generate energy for you instead of giving you a splitting headache. Okay. So breakdown depends on two degradatory enzymes, GABA-T and SSDH. Now, if you notice over on the right-hand side, I've got a list of inhibitors. I've also got a list of cofactors. I don't have any of those in color at this point in time, unless you're going to be a specialist. Not really worth your time to learn any of those. Some of these inhibitors, though, have a lot of clinical utility. So I actually went ahead and listed them. One of them should be pretty easy to remember. Its name is gabaculine, or gabaculine, if you prefer that pronunciation. Starts with GABA, though, and it blocks GABA-T. Gabaculine, or gabaculine, blocks GABA-T. That drug is not very widely used because it's too specific. It prevents the complete breakdown of GABA because it blocks that first step. A drug that's more commonly used, anybody ever know what that is used for clinically? Is one called valproate. What's it used for? Okay, it is used occasionally for bipolar. It's also more commonly used as an anticonvulsant. Valproate. Okay, and valproate not only blocks GABA-T, but also blocks SSDH. It actually increases the amount of inhibition by preventing breakdown of GABA, valproate. In fact, when you take valproate, you even get more of a bargain. Valproate not only inhibits the two breakdown enzymes, GABA-T and SSDH, but it also facilitates production of GABA. It increases the activity of the biosynthetic enzyme, GAB. Probably more useful for the manic phase of bipolar than the depressive phase, but definitely helpful in a lot of different types of seizure disorders. Valproate. So it blocks SSDH and blocks GABA-T, but facilitates the biosynthetic enzyme GAD. Okay. All right, given what we've seen about there are a number of different varieties of the different subunits, there's more than one type of alpha subunit that could go into GABA receptors. You think GABA receptors everywhere in your brain are the same? Nope. Good guess. They, again, are differentially expressed in different regions. All there was on the last slide was you block SSDH and GABA-T, and you facilitate GAD. Okay, so you don't have to draw the whole picture. Okay. So if we look in different regions in the nervous system, we have different subtypes of GABA-A receptors. Who would like to learn all the variety of pharmacology for all these different subtypes? No? Again, in the future, this is going to be increasingly important that we get much more specific in our pharmacology. For instance, if we could target just the ones in cerebellum, we could probably do something about certain types of movement disorders without causing sedative effects in the whole rest of the nervous system. If we could do things targeting the ones that are very highly expressed in the hippocampus, and we could have effects that might avoid some of the problems with learning and memory that an awful lot of the current drugs have. So we're going to need that specificity information in the future. How much of that do you think is taught in medical schools these days? Pretty close to none. Okay. And we have a lot of future medical students, so hopefully when you get to the class that's titled Medical Pharmacology, you'll ask about this regional specificity and get them to actually include it in their curriculum rather than ignoring it, so that you can actually have some benefit to patients instead of just going, oh, well, that drug didn't work either. Well, here, I got some free samples of this one today. Let's try that. And use a more scientific approach to treatment of various disorders. Okay. Have we mentioned IV curves ever before? Okay. You should be very used to looking at IV curves. That might be a hint that there might be information that you should be able to work with on the exam related to IV curves as well. Again, when we're looking at the x-axis on an IV curve, is that current or voltage?
Voltage.
So what's on the y-axis? Current. What's an upward movement on these axes? Inward or outward current? Outward. So downward is inward. And this would be hyperpolarized or depolarized? Hyperpolarized and depolarized. Like we've seen for an awful lot of these other neurotransmitters, these ligand-gated receptors As soon as we activate anywhere close to the resting potential, we get a really strong inward current or GABA receptors. Same sort of thing for the glycine receptors. Same sort of thing for glutamate receptors or nicotinic receptors. In this case, though, it's a negatively charged ion coming in, so it's going to hyperpolarize the membrane. Which one didn't we have a nice straight line for? Anybody remember? Of the ligand-gated receptors. There was only one that didn't have a nice straight line. It was a calcium channel. It was because of magnesium block. So what kind of receptor was it? The NMDA receptor. It had one that was more sort of J-shaped or fishhook-shaped. If you don't recall that, go back and look at your notes and look at the portion, particularly in the Hammond book, about that. Okay? It's critically different from the other types of transmitter systems and how it generates the physiological effects that it causes. Again, what's the Hill coefficient for GABA receptors? It takes two molecules to activate a GABA A receptor. Okay. Have we talked about the phenomenon of desensitization before for other transmitter receptors? What's desensitization analogous to? Inactivation. Okay. GABA A receptors show desensitization. So here we have application of GABA, this bottom trace. This whole time, GABA is applied. 20, 30 seconds or so. And yet, the IPSP begins to run down or desensitize very quickly after the application of the transmitter begins. We've seen that repeatedly for other systems. In the case of GABA-A, we don't understand exactly what causes that, but we do know something that can slow it down. We have plenty of ATP present near that receptor that slows the rate of desensitization. ATP does not directly bind to GABA-A receptors. So that gives us a hint it must be acting through some enzyme system. Not yet identified. There's a potential project for many of you if you wanted it. Find out how that works. Okay. So these run down or desensitize just like many of the other types of systems that we've looked at previously. Here's an odd effect on the physiology of a drug that we've talked about multiple times now today. The drug, again, is nipocotate. What was it that nipocotate does? Blocks GATs, okay? The transporters, blocks the glycine transporters. This is looking at its effect on an IPSP generated by application of GABA. One thing that it does is make the IPSP smaller in amplitude. Not as much current flow through those GABA-gated chloride channels. But it makes the IPSP last longer. The current continues to flow for a longer period of time. Any guess why that might be? You've got the information available to you already. Why it causes these effects? Because it does what?
Because the amplitude is smaller.
The amplitude is smaller, so why is the amplitude smaller? Does it block the VIAATs? Yes. Okay. If you block the vesicular transport to some degree, how much transmitter gets into the vesicle? Smaller amount. So the current that's generated by that smaller amount of transmitter is smaller. This is a dose-dependent effect. If we gave enough nipocotate you'd have hardly any IPSP at all. Why would it last longer? Why, once it got out there, would it last longer? Because it can't be transported back into the neuron. Because it's blocking a number of the available transporters to get it back out of the synapse. So the effect persists longer. This actually helped identify the targets. Because originally we just had the physiological data. We didn't know what proteins it was interacting with. It affects both the vesicular filling mechanism and the reuptake mechanism. So you get less transmitter put out, but it stays out there longer. Does that make sense to everybody? All right, what do we do with drugs that affect GABA-A receptors? Any uses for them? Clinically or therapeutically, they're used for a wide range of effects, mostly to inhibit the system, or in the case of antagonists, to block inhibition. So we'll see a wide range of drugs that have sedative properties, calm individuals down, hypnotic properties, in other words, they make you sleepy or render you unconscious, that reduce anxiety, so we call those drugs anxiolytics. Anxiolytics. And of course, they're critically involved in much of the treatment of seizure disorders, things like epilepsy and various other disorders. Now, of course, every drug that exists is only available by prescription, correct? No. So there are a lot of non-prescription or non-approved use of drugs. We'll look at one of those in a moment that has gotten considerable negative press for its involvement in criminal activity, Rohypnol, to render people unconscious and then make them available as targets for unwilling participation in various acts. Again, same general uses that these were used for clinically, they can also be used in a non-approved manner. Recreational purposes, in other words. And with this particular category of drugs, we get into some related issues that we're going to talk about a lot more through the rest of the semester. Issues of tolerance, of dependence, of addiction, and potential problems of overdose. We talked about tolerance earlier. It affects the shape of dose response curve, shifts them in a particular way. Does anybody remember what kind of shift?
Right.
A rightward shift in the dose response curve. It takes a larger amount of drug to get the same effect. How about addiction? We talked about that any? Just very, very generally. And we'll talk about it a lot more after this exam, where people increasingly seek out the drug. If they can't get a prescription, they might go to another doctor. If they can't convince any doctor, they'll start looking for it by other means, sometimes by theft, sometimes just by talking to someone they know. To the point where they become physiologically and psychologically dependent on the drug. They can't function normally, or whatever their normal state has now become, without the drug. And we'll talk a lot about that later on. How about issues of overdose? Can you die from taking drugs that affect GABA receptors? Yes, you can render yourself so unconscious that you no longer carry out normal activities like regulating your breathing or your heart rate. Amount of carbon dioxide can build up in your system to the point where normal metabolism can't be sustained. Plus, it has some unusual, nasty-looking side effects, like invoking the emetic reflex. Does everyone know what the emetic reflex is? Vomiting. The Australians have a colorful word for that. They call it the technicolor yawn. They seem to be sort more of a fan of it down in Australia than here. But that can be potentially fatal if you're unconscious and choke on your own vomit. All right. This is a complicated looking chart. Again, don't panic. We're going to go through it piece by piece. And in fact, there was way more information than would fit onto this chart. So we're going to go through the first part, the simpler part first, and then the parts that wouldn't fit on here second. All right? Not surprisingly, we have agonists and antagonists for GABA-A receptors. Competitive agonist, the endogenous substance, is GABA. GABA. Gamma-aminobutyric acid. GABA. There's an exogenous drug that's often used. Muscimol. Muscimol. Both of those will produce inhibition. All right, then we have drugs that compete for that same binding site. The one that's most commonly used, bicuculin. Bicuculin. That prevents inhibition, blocks the binding of GABA. So what do you think the overt effect would be if you gave somebody a dose of bicuculin? You'd probably have a seizure. There are other ones. That one sounds like a magazine of some sort about inhibition. But bicuculin is the one that's probably worth your time to learn because it's the most widely used. All right, then we have non-competitive antagonists. They don't do anything to the binding of GABA. And again, to your advantage, you've already learned two of them. The bitter toxin one, picrotoxin, and its active metabolite, one that you get twice as much poison for the same price, picrotoxinin. Again, they block that chloride channel at the center of GABA receptors, just like they do for glycine receptors. There are a number of others. The ones you're most commonly going to see have this suffix. Sifat. Isobisifat is one of the most potent ones. They have that sifat suffix. They're also non-competitive antagonists just for GABA receptors, not for glycine receptors. Okay. So those are categories we're used to looking at, agonists and antagonists, competitive and non-competitive. For GABA, we also have to consider this other category, allosteric modulators. Allosteric modulators. These do things to the protein that affect its function. And that includes several categories of drugs. Barbiturates, or barbiturates, if you prefer that pronunciation. Benzodiazepines, since most people can't spell benzodiazepines, I put the abbreviation BDZ, benzodiazepines, substances that are known as neurosteroids, break that word down, what kind of cells do you think they affect? Neurons. And what kind of compounds are they? Steroids. Okay. Neurosteroids. One I'm sure you've never heard of before. Ethanol. We seen any other kind of receptor that ethanol affected? NMDA receptors. Did it enhance the function of NMDA receptors or block it? Block it, okay. It also makes these more effective. And finally, some other sedative drugs like propofol. Propofol, I sometimes use surgically, propofol, to enhance inhibition. All right, we're going to talk about each of these categories here in a bit more detail. Everybody got the general categories down? Okay. Let's look first at a little bit of their effect on IPSPs. Okay, if this is a normal GABAergic IPSP, you just apply GABA for the amount of time that it would come out of the synapse. Wash it back off, it doesn't desensitize because that's a brief period of time. You applied it again, you get very similar IPSP again. Everybody clear on that first part? Okay. Now if we add in other drugs along with GABA, add in the drug diazepam. Anybody know what category diazepam falls into? It's a benzodiazepine, a BDZ. It enhances the IPSP, makes it larger. Benzodiazepines facilitate inhibition. They don't have effect by themselves. They have to be paired with GABA. They facilitate the receptor-mediated effects of GABA. If you wash off the diazepam, GABA then has its original properties. Okay, now if instead of adding a benzodiazepine, we add phenobarbital along with GABA. What category does phenobarbital fall into? It's a barbiturate. Barbiturates have a similar effect. These are dose dependent, so I selected doses that have similar effects here. Again, you can wash off the barbiturate effect, and GABA goes back to having a similar original effect. Now we add a compound like allopregnanolone. Allopregnanolone, any guess on what category that is? It's a neurosteroid.
Endogenous Valium?
Well, that was a simplification of it. It is an endogenous neurosteroid. Yeah, it's sort of the drug that you make instead of having to take Valium. Okay. Allopregnanolone. Again, you can wash off that effect. Instead of that, you add ethanol along with GABA. Ethanol potentiates the inhibition. You can wash that off. And in fact, most of the volatile anesthetics tend to also potentiate GABAergic inhibition. Not because they directly interact with the GABA receptors, but what kind of channels did they open? Not chloride channels. Two fingers should be a clue. Not calcium. Tandem pore potassium channels. And remember, everything we talked about these ion channels, the voltage-dependent ones, is on this next exam. Oops. I guess some people are going to have a busy weekend. All right. So all of these different modulatory substances enhance the effects of GABA. They produce greater inhibition. This next chart, I don't expect you to remember anything from. But again, those of you who plan on going into a clinical field, expect to learn much, much longer lists than this in the future. You're going to need to know the time course of any specific drug that you contemplate giving to a human patient. Okay. This just looks, for instance, comparing the length of duration of some of these modulatory substances. Some might be relatively short-acting. Short is a relative term. Here, short means, you know, an eighth to a third of a day. Others might last half a day, up to a day. Others last multiple days. And some of these are very commonly prescribed drugs, like diazepam. What's the other name for diazepam? Valium. It doesn't just have sedative effects for a day. It has effects that last multiple days. In fact, Valium is a particularly bad example, as we'll see in a minute, because it has lots of active metabolites. It gets broken down into other drugs that still have sedative effects. I don't expect you to learn any of these time courses now, though. Okay. I also, again, never expect you to learn any of the molecular structures. This isn't a chemistry class, but there are differences between these different modulators. It's the general structure of a barbiturate, and you can hang different side groups off of it and come up with different barbiturates. Okay. The ones that you're most likely to see used clinically, I colored the two that are the most commonly prescribed, phenobarbital, and then the one that's still most widely used experimentally, pentobarbital. Phenobarbital, you would probably get a prescription for. Phenobarbital is mostly used in labs. But pretty much anything that ends in bital or barbital or even pentol is a barbiturate. And those will greatly increase inhibition, dose dependently. These actually seem to facilitate binding of GABA to the receptor. So what's another term we would use for that? They would increase the affinity of the receptor for the ligand. Okay. So these barbital suffixes. Completely different structure for benzodiazepines. Again, I don't expect you to memorize structures. But again, this is the basic structure, and you can then hang different side chains off of it and come up with slightly different variants of benzodiazepines. Some of them get metabolized really quickly. Some are very resistant to metabolism. Some, when they get metabolized, get converted into another benzodiazepine that still has activity. The next chart, you're going to groan because there's a lot of names on it. This is the most widely prescribed category of drugs in the U.S., benzodiazepines. We must have a lot of nervous people, and not all of them have a pharmacology exam coming up on Tuesday. Okay. The one that's most widely known is up here at the top, diazepam or Valium. I wrote some of the trade names up there, even though they are marketed under other trade names as well. The name you should clearly remember is the generic one, diazepam. So if they've got that "aza" in their name, that's probably a benzodiazepine. Aza, in the middle of the name. We have drugs like chlordiazepoxide, marketed as Librium. Flurazepam, marketed as Dalmane. Oxazepam, as Cirax. Literally millions of prescriptions written for these drugs every year. Nordazepam, we'll look at more in a moment. You can get a prescription for that, or you can get it for free. You can get nordazepam for free if you take diazepam, because that's one of its active metabolites. And actually, diazepam is cheaper. The The one that I've mentioned that has a very bad reputation, and you cannot get by prescription, you can't legally obtain typically any longer, is flunitrazepam. Flunitrazepam, once marketed as Rohypnol. You might know any other names for that drug? Roofies. Not a nice substance, particularly if it's mixed with alcohol, which also facilitates GABAergic inhibition. Very commonly renders people unconscious quickly. There are some partial agonists. The only one probably worth you well to learn is bortezomib, and it's got that "aza" in the center. There are a handful of competitive antagonists. The one that's most widely used is fumazenil. Fumazenil. The name doesn't help a lot. It's still got the "aza," but it's an antagonist. It's not a particularly long-acting antagonist, though. So if someone overdoses, say, on Valium, you're going to have to keep repeating the dose of flumazenil to keep them alive until they clear all of that diazepam dose and the nordazepam dose that they generate from it. Overdoses on benzodiazepines are serious problems. Finally, we've talked about this category once or twice before, an inverse agonist. An inverse agonist. What does an agonist do? It causes the effect, right? An inverse agonist reverses that effect. So if this normally facilitates inhibition, what would an inverse agonist do? Reduce inhibition in the presence of GABA. Okay. Again, these seem to act by affecting the affinity of the GABA-A receptor for GABA. And very recent research has given a name to the binding site for benzodiazepines. It's close to the GABA binding sites. They're now called omega sites. Omega sites. And we've identified two different types, omega 1s and omega 2s. Unfortunately, marketing types at some of the drug companies have got a hold of that. Oh, this is a completely different kind of receptor. Now, it's on the GABA-A receptor. So in their marketing literature for these drugs, they've kind of obscured the truth. That's a kind way of saying they've lied about them. In fact, for about a decade, they marketed these as non-habit-forming drugs. Now they've taken that out of their marketing claims. These drugs do have addictive tendencies with long-term use. And those are the drugs that you've probably heard of as Ambien or Lunesta. What are those marketed for? Sleeping aids. The generic name is Zolpidem. Did I pronounce that one? S-Zopiclone. S-Zopiclone. If you ever listen to one of the television advertisements for these drugs, they sound pretty strange. Do not take if you're already unconscious. Okay, that seems like something they don't need to tell you. Do not take while you're driving. Driving under the influence of this drug is not suggested. May cause unusual sexual activity, gambling. It's been used as a defense in murder trials. Not successfully, so don't get any ideas. But people claimed, well, I was unconscious. I didn't know what I was doing. They may have actually been right. But legally, that's not been accepted as a defense. And the dose that you get in a typical tablet of one of these is usually not enough to render you unconscious. You usually have to be sleepy in the first place and headed in that direction. They also do not produce normal sleep patterns. People taking these do not get the normal amount of slow wave sleep or REM sleep. They get a much shallower stage 2 sleep typically. And then they have sleep deprivation problems the next day. And yet many people are prescribed these and take them for months on end. That might account for some of the other long listing of things in the ads. Strongly marketed, though. Well, no, they're different drugs. Lunesta is S-isopiclone and Ambien is zolpidem. You're sitting in a bad seat for seeing these. Does that help? I started looking at your line of sight there and realized you probably didn't see that. Okay. It's up there. It wasn't a dumb question, people, okay? Not at all. There aren't any dumb questions in here. All right. To make a little more sense of some of these drugs that are up here, let's look at this next diagram. You might recognize this organ? The liver. Most of these are metabolized in the liver. And when you take in a number of these different prescribed benzodiazepines, like diazepam, or chloride diazepoxide, or chlorazepate, or flurazepam, many of them then are secondarily converted into an active metabolite, nordazepam. So that it can also have effects as a drug. Or you could get a prescription for nordazepam. That would be somewhat shorter acting because it wouldn't have the life cycle of these other drugs. But even nordazepam gets further converted in the liver into oxazepam. So again, you're getting another free drug from your prescription. And it's only when it's then further metabolized that it is rendered inactive. There's other drugs that are considered short-acting, like temazepam. Small amount of that gets converted into the last of those metabolites, oxazepam. Most of it bypasses that, though, and gets directly excreted. Remember the iLADME system, the tail end of that? Okay. Or we have other drugs that don't ever get metabolized, lorazepam, but they're pretty rapidly excreted from the system. Those would be considered short-acting benzodiazepines. So most of the benzodiazepines are long-acting because they're slow to metabolize, and when they are metabolized, you get all these other free drugs. First converted to nordazepam, and then that is further converted into oxazepam, all of which are biologically active.
So are you assuming here every molecule is converted? Like what's the
most of these are not excreted without metabolism. It's a rare few that get excreted in large volume without metabolism. So again, the pharmacology of benzodiazepines is complicated, not because of the binding sites necessarily, but because of their metabolism. Every transmitter system has its own peculiarities. And it's good to keep track of the differences between the different systems. Okay? You'll never have to draw a anatomically correct picture of a liver. Trust me. I can't draw an anatomically correct picture of a liver. Kyle, can you draw an anatomically correct picture of a liver? But it might be nice to know if some of these get converted into other forms. Okay. All right, we got some more categories left. Neurosteroids. Okay, they're not Valium, but they do a similar effect in your brain. Okay. From the name of these, you might guess a state where they might be prominently produced. You might know any physiological state that is involved in these names.
Pregnancy.
One of them, allopregnanolone, is an agonist. It enhances inhibition. Another one, which can in fact be a metabolite of allopregnanolone, blocks it. It's a competitive antagonist. So Dr. Miller was partly right. Sure, the allopregnanolone does tend to have sedative calming effects. But unfortunately, there's another hormone there which has the other effect. Not all of the allopregnanolone gets converted into pregnenolone, but pregnancy is a time that's sometimes associated with swings in mood. Most of you probably have no experience with that. Don't count on that throughout the rest of your lifespan, though. Again, these are called neurosteroids. And there are others, but this is the primary ones. Okay? Is that enough? Got a little bit to study for the next exam, right?